Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. You can't have plant-based breakfast without a plant-based egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/hrn.
This week on Meetin' 3, it's the final episode of our series on global trade. We're thinking futuristically, from China's ambitious plans for a new Silk Road to the future of borders and automation.
If you're a banana, you know, it's easy to cross the border. But if you're a person who's trying to follow the jobs, it's a lot more difficult, if not impossible, to do so in an authorized and safe fashion.
They love food trucks and they love growing your own food because these things are not dependent on essentially government systems. So there's a whole politics to pretzels on the dark web.
Tune in to Meetin' 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Patayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Danny Tang, who is the founder of Box. Box is the Japanese-style pronunciation of box. And Box delivers to your door the experience of tasting authentic Japanese snacks, candies, and teas sourced directly from generations-old small family businesses. And if you visit Japan, you will instantly know that Japanese people are quite obsessed with both savory and sweet snacks. And elaborately packaged products are ubiquitous, and you can easily get addicted to them. So today, we'll discuss how Danny got into Japanese snacks, why he decided to start a business to deliver them to your door outside of Japan, unique Japanese snacks, artisanal producers he works with, and much, much more. Before we start, Japanese is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And I have a quick announcement. MOFAT, or the Museum of Food and Drink, is holding a fantastic online event on Wednesday, March 10th from 8 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The event is called the Miso Shoyu and Samurai, the Cuisine and Culture of Aichi Prefecture. Known as the home of the samurai, the Aichi Prefecture is celebrated for its exquisite white soy sauce and umami-rich miso, called Hacho Miso, among many other things. Located between Tokyo and Osaka, Aichi has a distinctive food culture. For example, if you order a cup of coffee at the coffee shop, you also get a free set of breakfast in Nagoya for some reason, which is the capital of prefecture. So it's in Nagoya. And during the event, there will be a cooking demo to introduce us to Aichi's unique food products. And Master Bladesmith Murray Carter, who came on the show too a while ago, who received the title of the 17th generation Yoshimoto bladesmith in Japan, will discuss Japanese craftsmanship. Also, food writer and culinary photographer Michael Holland-Tokil and I will have a discussion with a guest from Aichi about the unique food culture. For tickets, please go to MOFAT's website. It's www.mofat.org. It's MOFAD.org/events. And click on March 10th on the calendar. And you can also order specialty ingredients box with H products with your tickets before March 4th, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard. So hurry, quantities are limited. So I hope to see you there. Now let's start a conversation with Danny Tang. Hello, Danny. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Akiko. Thank you for that really wonderful intro, too. I love how you especially refer to our the Japanese snacks as addicting or addictive. Highly, highly agree with that.
Right. So first of all, so where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
Yeah, so I was born in New York City, right in West Village, actually. And my parents were actually living in Bronx at the time. They were refugees of the Khmer Rouge from Cambodia. And so I kind of was raised in Bronx a little bit, and then I moved over to New Jersey when I got a little older with my family and was raised there for the rest of the time. Growing up, we, of course, ate a lot of Chinese food. My parents are ethnically Chinese, with a little bit of mix of kind of Cambodian flair and some of the cuisine as well, and lots of Asian snacks from all the like kind of Chinese supermarkets that existed in Chinatown.
Wow. Okay. And so how did you get into Japanese snacks?
Yeah, I mean, so of course I had a little bit of exposure to it when like kind of growing up and just living in the States, but you know, a very way I put it is like kind of almost elementary education to it, the Pockies, the high chews, the things that people are very familiar with. However, I didn't really start super getting into Japanese snacks until I moved and lived there. So I lived in Tokyo for over 4 years, back after I graduated college and worked for a little bit. And during that time when I was living and working in Japan, I got to travel all throughout the country from Hokkaido to Kyushu to Okinawa and like really discovered and learned that every single region has its own like specialty. Even little cities have their own specialty snacks that are limited just to that area. And it was just so wonderful to see this kind of diversity of handmade or generational or just kind of regional, whatever it is, special snacks there around Japan.
Right. That's a great point, actually. Like we've been talking about, you know, with my guests, regional sake and other products, but snacks in Japan, in the region, they are so proud of what they have. And sometimes they have special characters and cute anime character looking stuff. So that's another thing that they really support local businesses too, I think.
For sure. And it's like, you know, because of the whole omiyage culture in Japan, where you're almost like have to, it's almost a must that whenever you travel, you bring back food or drink or something to share with your coworkers and family. It's like, there's just a whole economy around it, as well as this culture where you go somewhere and you find the best thing you can find that's like really represents that area to like share with your loved ones or coworkers back home. And so then that just gives rise to all this innovation that also occurs because there's so much demand for these products.
That's another really important point, right? That gift culture, omiyage, like souvenir or gift culture, is so embedded in the whole function of society. Like, you know, the corporate culture, there's the ochugen, that's the summer gift. If you work for a company, give a gift to your, you know, boss. And then at the end of the year, the osaibo, that's another thing. And also, like you said, I think when you take a summer vacation, Japanese people will say, what's the best thing to take home to share with my colleagues in Japan? If it's a, what's the classic New York City souvenir? And I was like, huh, I don't know, like bagels? Can you take back bagels? And then also, so that's why the Japanese packaged food is so conveniently separable. Like you can share, it's just shareable and beautifully packaged. So that's a design concept. And also sharing culture, it's so tremendously unique, I think, in Japan.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree.
Right. All right. So, you know, by the way, I was looking at your LinkedIn background and just you went to Stanford and you worked for Google and you worked at Rakuten, which is like an Amazon of Japan. It's like this amazing, obviously you're a super smart person. And then you're smitten with snacks. So that's kind of a interesting turn and I love that. So,
I wanted to do something I was passionate about and I love eating. I love food. I love how it brings happiness to people. And even though I worked in tech for a few years and I enjoy the like fast paced movingness of tech, it doesn't have the same type of like visceral impact that like sharing a delicious snack with somebody has for me.
Right. But I was really closely looking at your box website. And I mean, for the research purposes, I just started, I'll take a look. And then I got to spend so much time, but more than I thought I should. It's so well designed. And I know you have a tech background, but it's really well made. And there's a lot of information. So Yeah, I really enjoyed
your website.
And so let's talk about how unique Japanese snacks are. So what is the difference from those that you can find in the US or some other countries?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the big differences that a lot of people don't realize is just even taking a step back and the fact that in Japanese, there are many, many ways to refer to snacks. There's like okashi is a general term, but then there's dagashi, there's wagashi, yogashi, there's a whole level of, and they all mean slightly different things. And like, but I actually had a really hard time with this when I was first starting boxes. How do I convey in English the kind of subtleties of the fact that we're selling authentic premium Japanese snacks through Boksu? However, in English, it's usually just snacks or treats. And these are both relatively cheap sounding terms. And I'm just using this as an example to illustrate the fact that in Japan, there's many spectrum of snacks, the cheap kind of mass produced ones that and candy that kids like to eat. And then as you get older, the omiyage level of snacks that we talked about, which is more of the like okashi and wagashi type of level. And that alone shows the difference where there's this emphasis on craftsmanship, quality, taste, texture. It's very thoughtfully designed from the kind of packaging to the smell to the look of the product. And like all of that type of intention, I think is present not only in the US snacks, but snacks around the world, honestly.
Right. Actually, I was thinking about this question that I'm asking you, and then how should I answer it? And I thought, like in America, for example, muffins are amazing, right? But then if you go to a restaurant, there's amazing plated desserts. And in Japanese packaged snacks, they have both, right? Like very casual, mm-hmm. approachable muffin kind of thing. But also, I don't know how they designed the packaging that to keep that delicacy, like different subtle flavors in the factory packaged, beautiful, you know, carryable products. So that's what I thought was unique about.
I mean, Japanese food technology is just amazing. I think it's because there is a demand for it, but it's designed to stay fresh. You're absolutely right. From the packaging, from the way the snacks are made, but most importantly, it's because there is a desiccant in every single snack for the most part, which is the pack that goes in to remove the oxygen and from the air. So it keeps the snack fresh. In American snacks, it's a lot rarer to see individually packaged snacks of desiccants in them. And so things like little things like that all add to how Japanese food companies keep their stuff so fresh.
Right. And also when you open tiny little packaging, you don't have to struggle. It's like even too easy to open it so that inside is not broken and anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So for listeners who are not familiar with Japanese snacks, could you give us some examples of classic or typical Japanese snacks?
Sure. There's a whole range, right? There's it goes in spectrums of indirections from traditional to modern, from famous to not famous, from regional to international. International things that people are familiar with are like Pocky or Haichu, as I mentioned before, Pretz, Koala Mamachi, which is that little chocolate koala thing. Much more domestic in Japan, like just to the regional areas. There's like mango chiffon cakes from Miyazaki. There's like pineapple chinsko from Okinawa. Like it gets really specific to what type of agriculture you can find. A lot of cheese cookies from Hokkaido. It also ranges, like I said, from traditional, modern, traditional being things that are much more red bean based, like yokan, like monaka, which people may not be as familiar with. And then to the modern, that's people know more like the langdosha cookies, the baumkuchen cakes from Germany, et cetera. And so what's wonderful about Japanese snacks specifically, is that this whole spectrum is covered of everything I just mentioned. And it's done so well. All of it is very delicious. And that's what makes it so fun to do what I do.
Right. And, I don't go back to Japan like, you know, every month or something. But when I go back, there's always a new dessert or sweets that there's a line for. Like if you go to a supermarket, that item is sold out. Like one specific bakery, there's a specific sweet. People just line up for hours. So there's a very fast-moving market trend too. So people are crazy about dessert. Right. And actually, you mentioned Pocky a couple of times. And Pocky is one of the most, symbolic Japanese sweets. And I was looking at Where it came from, that originally it was made by Ezaki Griko, which is a big company for making snacks, and which is said headquartered in Osaka. And it was born in 1966. And it was the first chocolate snack that you can hold without missing your fingers. And the idea of the stick of biscuit dipped with chocolate came from the famous regional Osaka food, which is kushikatsu. That means cutlet in skewers. So the cutlet on skewers turned to be chocolate. I thought it was a very interesting idea. And then everywhere in the
That's
world,
really cool. I didn't realize Pocky was inspired by kushikatsu. I can see that. Yeah.
Right. Right. Okay. So so you founded Box in April 2016. So why did you open Box?
There's like a long story version, short story version, but basically, I came up with the concept of Boxu in November 2015, and I wanted to basically reiterate and launch as quickly as possible. Like, there's this whole concept of the MVP when you do startups, which stands for like the minimally viable product, meaning like just get it out as fast as you can and just start getting feedback from your customers and reiterate and improve on that product as time goes on. And so when I concepted it in November 2015, I actually did a beta launch in January 2016, just a couple months later, to like 20 friends. I like posted on Facebook and got friends to sign up and gave them a big discount. And from there, kind of gathered feedback for 2 months of what I can do better, how to improve the product, the curation, what people like, what they don't like, type of thing. And then took a month off in March to really kind of get ready for my official launch. And then, as you kind of know, we launched in April 2016. And it also worked out really nicely because in Japanese culture, April is always the start of the new year for a lot of things, from the school year to like new employees, whatever it is, the start of like kind of a new season with the cherry blossoms blooming. So it's like, it kind of was coincidentally worked out to be very symbolic with Boxu starting in April, that it lined up with Japanese kind of fresh start culture as well.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point, right? Like, you know, the fiscal year is different in Japan. It's more from April to March. So that's interesting. And so how do you define the concept of Boxu?
One of the big reasons I came up with the name Boxu is that, one, I mean, I thought it was a really cute pun to have the name of it just be box in English, right? Boxu meaning box. And as you know, it's the English imported loan word for Boxu. And in our logo itself, we also have the Japanese more traditional word, which is Hakko. They mean, you know, very similar things, but the way I kind of designed the logo and the branding is that Boxu is supposed to be like a modern, approachable interpretation of traditional Japanese culture, starting with snacks as is a really easy bridge to everyone. But like, it's called Boxu, so it could be a literal and metaphorical box for anything that can go in it to bridge to the world. So I use this as like kind of the first stepping stone to a much kind of bigger plan to really connect people around the world to authentic Japanese culture and food.
Right. Yeah, when I click on your website page, there's the box and the Japanese letter comes, like, you know, kind of like opening, and I like that. It's a romantic idea of box, right? Who doesn't want to have a box? It's a gift box. So I really thought it was a good name.
Plus, so, as a small little, like, kind of funny aside, was that the domain name was available, the way I spell it, BOKKSU. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. A 6-letter domain in this day and age. So I immediately bought boxu.com. And that just cinched the deal for me, the fact that I was able to get that domain.
Right. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So how many items do you carry on your website? And how do you find these products?
Yeah. So to kind of explain a little bit about the context, there's basically two big parts of the business at Boxu nowadays. One is the subscription box side, which is what we first launched with in April 2016. And that is like a monthly box that changes every single time. And for that one, we have about 12 to 14 different products that go in every single month. However, as of 3 years ago, starting from January 2018, we've launched what we call the Boxu Market, kind of like a Boxu Ichiba type of meaning, which means market in Japanese. And the idea there is that now when people discover these products in the box they really like, if they want more of it, they can. We offer it on our website. You can buy it individually on demand, shipped directly to you from Japan as well. And on that section of the site, 3 years ago, it was maybe about 20 to 30 SKUs, mostly SKUs being products, mostly things that were in the box. But nowadays, that part of the website and business has grown quite a lot. And now we have over 200 different products that we sell on demand. And from snacks to tea to matcha tea sets to kitchenware, we just launched a ramen collection a few weeks ago that's doing super well because Japanese instant ramen is also amazing, crazy delicious, and very different from like the cheaper cup ramen we see everywhere in America. And so there's a lot of expansion coming for Boxu into the future.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, if you go to Japanese supermarket, the instant ramen section, it's so competitive. It's like a joke. The whole shelf can be filled with 20, 30 different kinds of instant ramen. So that's very interesting that you started to carry it. I have to look up.
Mm-hmm.
And then you offer, like you said, you offer monthly subscription box. So what snacks are typically in the box, and what is the philosophy behind the selection to make it in one package?
Because a lot of our customers want to get to know Japan or Japanese food culture, but they don't know like what are the good ones, what, you know, like, et cetera, like what are premium, what's authentic and not. We've kind of set ourselves up to be the curator, the thoughtful, meticulous curator for them. So they rely on us for us to give them a great balance every single month based around some type of really fun cultural theme. And we actually plan out our themes first. So that's already planned out for the whole year. We do that 6 months to 12 months in advance. And for example, coming up next month, the theme is Sakura Spring, because that's what's coming up in March and April type of time period where the box is going to be curated full of a lot of delicious, brightly pink packaged Sakura and cherry blossom and ume, which are plum blossom snacks. We always have a mix of sweet and savory, although it leans a little heavily sweet, mainly because a lot of the kind of premium Japanese snacks are on the sweeter side. And then there's always a tea pairing every single month. And we're the first company to come up with that, the only company that does that well. And like that, and that's from my experience of having lived in Japan, where every time you eat these omiyage snacks, you almost always drink it with tea. It's very rare that you just kind of eat it by yourself, which is also a very different cultural thing from America, where generally speaking in America, you just kind of eat the snack. But like things just pair much better when you have a nice like genmaicha or hojicha or something. So that's kind of the idea of this box. And we create, like I said, curate 12 to 14 different products every month and put multiples of like maybe two of each to give people the idea that the chance to share, to like taste it, and then maybe have a little more later to kind of make it a whole experience to unbox with their loved ones together.
Right. And I really like the idea of the tea pairings. Like you said, if you get some sweet, like, oh, thank you so much. Well, let's get some tea. That's always the case. Always, 100%.
Mm-hmm.
So how popular is the subscription option? And do you think it's a good idea? If you don't know anything about Japanese sweets, shall we just sign up for a monthly subscription?
What do you mean when you ask how popular is a subscription option?
Yeah, like, you know, the percentage of the whole customers you have, people tend to go for, you know, the subscription option. I think my question is also, you know, related to how people are familiar with Japanese snacks. Because if you know, you can just go straight into the market section, right?
It's true. So, I mean, we are at our core. That's first and foremost is a, you know, subscription box, monthly subscription box company. That's what we launched with. We've been running that for almost 5 years now. The market section of it has only been around for about 3 years. And so the subscription box is the vast majority of our customer base is subscribed to Boxu, especially because most people don't know the products. And so they need to kind of be able to be introduced to it and discover it through the box. And then they can go buy in the market. Although certainly there have been people that subscribe for a few months and then decide that they've already found some things they like and they just go to the market and buy from there directly and then stop subscribing. That's totally great too. However, like 85%+ of our customer base is on the subscription model because it's just new every single month and they love that we keep things fresh and interesting and we never repeat. And like they learn something new every time as well because the themes are always different and we always have a 16+ page culture guide magazine that's in the box where we write it ourselves, we do our own photography, our own copy, we have a map of Japan. We show exactly where these products are from to then we sometimes have interviews or like, you know, stories about the makers that make these products, things like that, that really help get people immersed into exploring and experiencing Japan through Boxu.
Right. Okay, well, just by hearing it, I get excited, like, you know, before opening the box, what's inside, right? It's just like another excitement to present to yourself, but you don't know what's inside. Okay, so we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll discuss Japanese snack makers who have won their businesses over generations.
Just Egg is now the fastest growing egg brand in the United States. Bring more plant-based consumers in your doors with easy to use Just Egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/hrn. That's ju.st/hrn. Made from plants, Just Egg is a better egg for you and for the planet. It's healthier, with no cholesterol and less saturated fat, and it's more sustainable. Just Egg uses less water and generates fewer carbon emissions. Most importantly, it's delicious. For our listeners who operate a food service establishment, you can get a sample for free. Head to ju.st/hrn. That's ju.st/hrn. Just Egg makes a delicious plant-based addition to any menu. It's available as a liquid scramble. Great for omelets, frittatas, stir fries, and French toast. There's also a frozen pre-baked folded version that's ideal for filling breakfast sandwiches or topping salads. Chef Jose Andres calls Just Egg mind-blowing, and Bon Appetit says, it's so good, I feel guilty eating it. Put the fastest-growing egg brand on your menu. Get a free sample of Just Egg for your restaurant at ju.st/hrn.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Danny Tang, who is the founder of Box. Sorry, Box. Box delivers to your door. Yeah, Box too. That's cute. And Box delivers to your door the experience of tasting authentic Japanese snacks, candies, teas, sourced directly from generations-old small family businesses. All right. So you mentioned, you know, 20-page booklet explaining the product, how it came from and who made it, which is a lot of work. So why? It's a lot of work. So why
it is.
Did you do
no,
that?
It is. I mean, every month it's a lot of work. Every month's curation is a lot of work. We work with like 10 different vendors just to get a box, and it changes every single month. And so, you know, like we are fanatical and like meticulous about making sure each month's experience is outstanding. We love hearing from our customers that like, oh my God, no, this month was my favorite box ever. Box has really outdone themselves. Like we're always trying to raise that bar to give our long-term subscribers still something to look forward to every month. We've had people subscribing to us for like 4+ years now, which I'm just so excited about. And this booklet, this magazine that we produce is another piece of that whole puzzle of this whole, what makes Boxu so makes so many people passionate about what we do. And it, to give you a little context, when we first started, that was just a postcard. It was like a double-sided postcard with a little bit of information about the snacks. And it started off because most people can't read Japanese. And so we were just helping translate to like explain how to enjoy this product, what the common allergens are in it, if it's vegetarian or not, is it sweet or savory? Just to give some basic information so that people can have a context before they even bite into the product. And then that evolved from there to becoming like, then it was like a folded postcard and then became like a trifold thing. And then as of a couple years ago, we started making it into a magazine because there's just so much content now. We have a map of Japan, as I mentioned, that and it shows exactly where in Japan the snack is from. And so by doing this, we really are trying to transport our customers worldwide kind of like through Japan. It's almost like if you can't fly to Japan right now because of what's going on in the world, then we'll fly Japan to you through this box. And through this magazine and these beautiful pictures of all the like if the box is Kyoto themed, then we have a lot of pictures of the temples and the makers and the wonderful matcha snacks that come from Kyoto, etc. And that's what really ties the whole box together. Like, as opposed to other boxes out there, which are very random in the way they put snacks and candies in a box, we tightly curate it around the theme. So we want to make sure we have this booklet, this guide that really kind of ties it all together and makes them experience the food and the color and the taste and the culture all at the same time.
Oh, wow. So I really have to order a box just for the sake of even just looking at the book. And I have to say, I think what you're doing, I really appreciate what you're doing, because you are acting as a marketer for small producers. And for each of them, there's no way to promote themselves that you're doing for them. And you have on the website, there is a page, Makers, where you can find several producers' fantastic documentary videos that you created in Japan yourself. And I watched all each one of them, and I was moved. So yeah, I just kind of want to say thank you for, on behalf of the producers, how much value you are producing for their, you know, very traditional small businesses.
Thank you. I mean, I also really grateful to the makers themselves for, they spent the whole day or two sometimes with me and my small documentary film crew, giving me all that time. They're busy, busy people themselves. And, you know, like it was something I'd been dreaming about doing for years, even from the beginning of starting Boxu, is that like I would meet these makers when I used to go to Japan. I used to fly to Japan every 2 months and to go meet with like makers or partners or whatever. And we would go out and have dinner and drinks together after meeting. And like, they would tell me their stories of like why in this day and age they took over the family business. Like, because it goes back 120 years and their grandfather, blah, 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 and all that. And I'm like, oh my God, these are amazing stories. Like, and I shouldn't be the only one to hear them. Like, the whole world should hear them. Our customers should hear them. And this is something that is very different from America. America doesn't have a strong concept of like familial generational family businesses, especially ones so obsessed with food craftsmanship. And so I just love the philosophy on kind of craftsmanship and life that all of them had. And I wanted to show that through this documentary. And so we kind of did our best to be scrappy and got some people together and went over and created this. It was a ton of work though, that's for sure.
Right. Oh, it was so worth it. And listeners, I really suggest that you watch it, because it really feel how producers put their efforts, soul and everything into their products, and their little, you know, blogs added to it to feel what you couldn't fit in each video. So yeah. Are you going to produce more videos?
I mean, it would depend on like kind of a lot of things, but we really want to do a season two. The issue, of course, is that none of us can fly to Japan right now, given all of the different suspensions going on throughout the world. So,
right. Hopefully next year.
Yeah.
I'll keep watching. All right. So how many artisanal producers like them do work with?
We have direct relationships with, at this point, probably over 100 family, like producers all throughout Japan. Wow. It's been a ton of work to also make these relationships and to maintain them.
Right. So maybe you can give us some examples of producers.
Yeah. So for example, there's a company called Homma Anpan that's up in Hokkaido. And he's in one of our documentaries, but he's this amazing, jovial, super friendly guy who's the fifth generation president of this company that makes anpan, which is traditional Japanese red bean bun. And he's like kind of tried to modernize it in a lot of ways. He's made like yuzu anpan and like pumpkin anpan and like different chocolate anpan is a really popular one during Valentine's Day. And so kind of really cool, like almost modern infusions of this that is able to be individually packaged and then shipped around the world. Like normally anpan is really hard to ship and stay fresh, but their food technology is also quite good. And like kind of listening to his story about why he decided to take over the family business. And like he was a normal salaryman working all around Japan for many years before he went back to do so. To one of my favorites is our 100-year-old candy maker down in Kyoto. It's also fifth generation, coincidentally. And the current president is, the new president is going to be, is quite young. And also when I asked him why he wanted to do so, he talked about just having a lot of pride about his family and the fact that in Kyoto, 100 years is still a relatively young company, and that he wants to see his family company go to 200, 300 years, which I was just like, oh my God, I can't believe you just said that 100 years is a young company. And because in America, that would be almost like unthinkable. Some of these companies in Japan are older than America itself. And it's just like kind of really interesting to see that. And so hearing their stories to like the you know, not to always talk about the super old ones. I mean, there's only a 10-year-old company named Fubion that's based out of Kyushu and Tokyo. And he's a relatively, once again, young founder. But his whole thing was that he wanted to take the regional's fruit produce to this like national level, where if it's in Kyushu area, he makes a lot of snacks with mentaiko and strawberry. If it's Tokyo, he has a lot of like apple and things like that. And to really like make them more into the beautifully packaged omiyage level that would be sold in the airports and the train stations. And he has grown so fast, his company. And so I was really impressed with his modernization as well.
Right. So, okay. I hope really you can keep featuring more producers. And again, you're really acting as a marketing arm for those people who have no idea how to sell outside of Japan. So hopefully you're going
to
keep
going. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we are so excited to be able to provide the service, because a lot of these makers are going through a really hard time, even before COVID and especially during COVID, because just when Japan's population is decreasing and you can't just only sell domestically. And also young Japanese people are unfortunately not that interested in traditional Japanese snacks. I think young Japanese people are interested in like international snacks. Like everybody wants what they don't know and don't have type of thing. But the rest of the world is like so hungry for Japanese products. And that's where we can come in and help uplift and elevate these artisan stories and products to the world stage. And I'm really excited to like keep them alive for generations to come, hopefully.
Mm. The funny thing is that if something's recognized outside of Japan, Japanese people realize that, oh, wow, that's awesome. So we have to consume more of that. So you're creating, redeveloping the Japanese market too, hopefully in the near future. So what are the demographics of your customers who are eating Japanese snacks?
Yeah, I mean, there's honestly a really wide range. I truly believe that when I was first starting, a lot of people thought that my demographics were very small and niche. Like I got that a lot as feedback. Like, oh, this must be a very niche business. It must be only like Japanese expats around the world or something. And I was like, no. Like the Japanese cultural market is exploding worldwide. Like more and more people are visiting Japan, studying Japanese, eating Japanese food, watching anime, whatever it is, people are consuming it. And so it spans a lot of different types of people. In our case, the vast majority of our customers are not Japanese. They're Caucasian women between the ages of 25 and 44 is the largest piece, but there's all types, like Asian Americans make up a big part of it. We ship worldwide, to be clear, we've shipped directly from Japan. So we have customers in about 100 countries around the world as well. US being the single largest market, but we have Canada, Australia, Singapore, like Israel. Like there's honestly big Japanese food culture lovers everywhere. And so we kind of see the spectrum all across. Generally speaking, they do lean a little bit female, and they lean a little bit in the 25 to 44 because it's a bit of a luxury product.
Right. And if you could expand the ramen section, probably you get more male customers too, I guess.
Possibly, yeah.
So what items are most popular right now?
So we do have some like perennially popular items on both the snack and the sweet and savory sides. On the sweet side, there's probably two that are constantly always selling really well. One of which is what's called a white strawberry, and it's from this one maker in Nagano Prefecture. It's a white chocolate infused strawberry. So it's not covered or coated like people might normally think of it. It's actually a strawberry that's been freeze-dried to remove the water content, then re-infused through this patented process of liquid white chocolate. And then it's cooled down and it's delicious and beautiful. And you crunch into it and it's like tart and smooth and sweet all at the same time.
Wow.
It's like eating, yeah, a strawberry made out of chocolate.
Oh my God, number two would be. Yeah, that's really high tech, right? I didn't know that's possible.
One of our best sellers by far. Number two would be a kind of our candy maker in Kyoto making either the sakura candy with real sakura petals inside the kind of the candy itself. or the yuzu sake candy, which was an exclusive collaboration between the two of us, because I personally love yuzu shu, which is people know as yuzu sake. And so I wanted that in the candy, and it tastes so good. There's like real yuzu peel and real sake in there. So those are really, on the savory side, like seaweed tempura chips with sudachi citrus is also a big, big seller. A lot of people love the crunch and the tartness of that.
So sudachi, for listeners who are not familiar with sudachi. Sudachi is a kind of citrus, and it's similar to, it's green. It's not yuzu, but there's a very unique flavor, and it's addictive. And it comes always with nabe dishes in Japan. So, wow, that's exciting. Okay. And so what else do you have?
I mean, we've sold probably we've carried hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, SKUs, like different products by now. But what are some other big favorites I have? I really like these, let's see. I kind of have to think about it a little bit, but like we've been getting into those premium gummies that Japan is really big for as well. And the funny story about that is that my Japan team, the team that kind of curates the box, I used to do the curation way back in the day, but now we have a team that's dedicated towards doing that. They've been trying to push me to put in more like gummies in our boxes for a while, but I kind of refuse because in my mind as a Westerner, a little bit like gummies are seen as a kid's thing, like gummy bears and things. But in Japan, there's like also once again, adult, mature flavored, delicious, like real fruit juice gummies. And oh my God, they've been selling like crazy for us too. There's these like puree gummies with grape and with lemon. There's also been this like lychee gummy that has like real lychee juice inside. That's really, really good. The things like this are just like the texture and the taste are unlike anything I've ever had in America.
Wow.
So I highly recommend checking those out. And recently, since I mentioned it as well, our ramens have been selling super duper well. Like we have this one tonkotsu instant ramen that I was shocked at how good it was. Like it tasted like a ramen shop's ramen. It was that authentic. And I was like, oh my God, how is this even possible that this instant cup ramen could taste this good from Japan?
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that makes me think that, you know, like Kit Kat is known for really a huge variation of flavors globally. And when it comes to the Japanese market, they have a ridiculous huge range of new flavors and like Japanese sake flavors to something that you even don't think of. And like pokies too. So it sounds like you really showcases, you know, the variation of Japanese creativity when it comes to the snacks. And yeah, I really enjoyed perusing what you have on your market. So that's exciting. And you keep adding more products?
Yeah, the goal is to keep growing the market. It's one of our big kind of expansion goals for this year. We currently have about over 200 products on there, but maybe depending on how things go, we're trying to get to about 1,000 products by end of year.
Right. And I got this number that in December 2019, books shipped orders to over 15,000 subscribers to 70 plus countries. But since then, how has COVID affected your business?
Yeah, COVID has been, it's been complicated for sure. Like there have been ups, there have been downs, there have been a lot of downs last year. To be perfectly honest, when COVID was first hitting the world and then America in March, like things were really scary. I mean, not just on the kind of personal health side, but like our whole business is that we ship internationally from Japan to the world directly to customers. And the one thing that definitely got affected by COVID is the severe reduction of international flights and how difficult global shipping logistics have become. And like we were doing our best to work and trying to survive through it. And then I distinctly remember on April 22nd, that was like the worst day of 2020 for me. Japan Post announced their suspension to the US. And Japan Post has still suspended shipping to the US. It's been almost a year later now. And you still cannot that easily ship to the US from Japan. And I for a bit thought that, my God, is this going to be over? Like my 4 years of hard work, is it going to just go down the toilet? But I worked, as soon as I got over that initial shock, I like worked my butt off for 2 weeks, contacted everybody in logistics and shipping that I could find, talk to like UPS, FedEx, lots of third-party logistics companies, and fortunately found an alternative solution to keep shipping to the US. So that allowed us to keep our business humming and running along, even though it was very scary for a little bit. But having said that, it's still, the shipping got more expensive now worldwide, even for, and so that's been really tough for our margins and all of that. We still are dealing with that on a regular basis. We're country, like, we can ship there, we can't ship there. It keeps changing all the time. Having said that, the silver lining from this whole experience is, well, one, I'm now a big expert on global shipping logistics, but two, people are stuck at home and they're itching to travel and they're itching to have new experiences. And we've seen a big surge in interest in what Boxer has to offer, because it's not just things you can find in your local market. It's things that are truly only you can find in Japan. And so we've seen our growth grow very, very strongly from end of 2019 to end of 2020. It's been a very interesting time to be in this industry right now.
Right. Amazing. So I heard Japan is finally rolling out vaccines. So hopefully your shipment issue is going to be resolved before too long.
Hopefully. I've been thinking and hoping it would be resolved. I always think, oh, maybe just a couple more months. But at this point, it's safer to make a lot of different backup plans just to keep the business continuity going, type of thing.
So that was like a good learning experience at early stage of business, I guess.
Yes, it's definitely made me something like... The way some people put it is that we've gone through kind of like a wartime CEO, and we've gone through this really tough period to keep our company alive and together and kind of motivated to keep providing the service for our customers worldwide.
Well, it's hard to imagine what could it be, the bigger issues, right, for your business. So yeah, you're now invincible, I guess.
In the startup world, there's always something that comes up. So for the last 5 years of running the business, every couple of months there's some crisis. So I'm just getting ready to deal with the next things for sure.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's the right mindset. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So based on that, what are your plans?
For what?
I don't know. It could be anything, like considering what you've done so far. It could be long-term, short-term.
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways we can go with this. A lot of it will depend on a lot of global situation and circumstances, but we certainly plan to keep providing the high level of excellent curation and service we have with our core business of the subscription box. We also plan to expand our market, as I mentioned. Like, we currently have only about 200 SKUs. We definitely plan to expand that to a lot more, to become the go-to place for people to come and find Japan exclusive authentic products from artisans with stories, et cetera. We're going to try and have more of that up there. We also plan to potentially do a lot more partnerships with Japanese makers and businesses and companies, and ways to really elevate and help each other out, because Boxu is the only company out there that's supporting the artisans in these ways. Most other ones are mostly using like mass produced candies and things like that. And then kind of top of that, like, we are looking into possibilities of releasing new types of subscription boxes, whether it be a ramen box or something else. We're kind of still thinking about that. But yeah, there's big plans for this year. I can't reveal all of them just yet, unfortunately, but because some of it not even at the starting line. So it's all just kind of ideas. But Boxu is here to stay and here to keep growing and providing. Our whole mission is to inspire hunger for authentic Japanese products. So there's a lot more we can do for that.
Right. So listeners, if you haven't tried looking at the Boxu website, you should, because it's amazing. It's fun and informative and makes you hungry. And yeah, the snacks are not going to disappoint you. So, okay. So where can we find your updates online and social media?
Yeah. So, an easy thing, we're on Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is all just, at Boxu, BOKKSU. But the best way to stay up to date on what's happening is to sign up for our mailing list. If one just goes to boxu.com, scroll right to the bottom, there's a place to put in one's email. And we're very kind of good about keeping our whole worldwide mailing list base kind of updated on new product launches, new features, sales, like whatever we're doing, kind of maker stories, things like that. We send through email quite a lot.
Okay, great. So I really wish you luck and thank you for joining us today, Danny.
Thank you very much, Akiko, for having me. This has been really fun.
Right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatayama.com. Japanese is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer today is Man Wong, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japanese is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.
Listening.